At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows you've got a job to do, and we help get it done. With the MyLowe's Pro Rewards program, eligible members save more with volume discounts on qualifying orders through a quote of $2,000 or more. Join for free today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Offer can't be combined with any other discount, contract, and or special pricing. Exclusions, more terms, and restrictions apply. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Welcome back to another edition of the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, and it is a special bonus free agency edition. Bobby Marks, the front office insider for the Vertical, he joins me. We recap the Chris Paul deal, we talk about Phil Jackson's departure in New York, and we look ahead to Gordon Hayward's free agency, Blake Griffin's free agency, and some under-the-radar guys that could make an impact on their teams or different teams sometime next year. All right, let's go. Joining me on the pod, Bobby Marks, the front office insider for The Vertical, making one of his many appearances and, sadly, his last appearance here on The Vertical Podcast. What's up, Bobby?
Hello, Chris. How are you?
I'm going to miss these little chats, Bobby. These sort of bi-monthly chats that we tend to have here.
Oh, on I agree with you. Yes. I won't miss you busting my balls about the Boston trade. But I think it bothers my wife more than it bothers me. It doesn't bother me anymore. I've grown accustomed to, and I know we can have fun with it.
How many people do you have to block on social media after I take one of my annual shots at you? Not even annual, a couple of times a year shots at you for that trade.
You know, it's funny, Chris. I was in LA about a couple weeks ago, and I went out to get like Starbucks at 7:30 in the morning. And I like to look at my notifications because I if people ask me questions, I like to respond. Right. You know, good questions. I had some guy say like, "Hey, I know you were the coffee guy there when you went to the finals in those 2 years there, and you had no role in that team, and you screwed that Nets team up for good." And I was like, "Whoa, man! I can't even go out and get coffee at like 7:30 in the morning."
People are harsh, man.
I take it. It's only sports.
Do you hit the block button there?
I do.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
mute is my thing. Like, I want to make people still follow me and still click on what I'm saying, but I like let them be talking at air. Like, yep. As long as I don't have to hear them, the mute button is one of the greatest, sort of technological advances of Twitter in the last 5 years.
No, it's a great tool. I just figured that I was blocking, and now it's just mute. Yeah. They can still follow me, but I'm not responding to you.
Yeah. All right, let's go out with a bang here. And I guess we should start, before we get to free agency, the news that broke over the last couple of days. And let's start with Chris Paul, the now former LA Clippers guard. I saw you tweeting late Wednesday night about how hard the Clippers and Rockets front office had to work to get this deal done. I mean, it seemed like the Clippers, or the Rockets rather, were acquiring as many non-guaranteed contracts as they could to make the financials of this work. Before we get into that part of it, what do you think of this deal? Houston, we have seen Daryl Morey in the past make big swings at big free agents, big trade acquisitions. Some he gets, some he doesn't, some work out, some don't. What do you think of the Chris Paul acquisition from a Rockets perspective?
Well, I give Daryl credit, and I said this at the trade deadline when they made the Lou Williams trade and they gave up a first-round pick. You know, some teams are content to kind of, you know, sit on the sidelines, and he addressed it yesterday that, you know, it's basically an arms race here and that he's loading up. And it goes back to, it's always about the next move, and you take that Lou Williams contract and now you package it with, with Beverly and Decker and those non-guarantees. And now he's got some work to do, though. Now he's got to figure out that bench. That is the thin bench, you know, outside of Eric Gordon there. It's, you know, most of those minimums, I don't know where they'll wind up if they even stay there. But I like it for Houston. I mean, I think if you ask yourself, Beverly was potentially could be going into his last year at a non-guarantee, and Lou Williams had was going into the last year. If you were able to, you know, move guys who maybe weren't part of your future and get Chris Paul for, you know, 4 or 5 years here, I think a lot of people would sign up for it.
Look, you add Chris Paul to the mix, you're in a good spot. I think Mike D'Antoni is going to find a way to make this offense even more efficient than it was last year, and it was a really efficient offense last year. I will say this deal doesn't come without risk. Number one, Chris Paul's 32 years old. We don't know when we're going to start to see some signs of decline. He's been really consistent over the last 4 or 5 years statistically, but he did miss 21 games last year with injury, and he did play the fewest minutes of his career last season with the Clippers. And I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I assume there's a wink-wink, nod-nod deal with Chris Paul that he will get the 5-year max at the end of next season. Now, of course, an injury or something catastrophic could change that, but you're talking about Houston investing in a guy who next season is going to be 33 years old and giving him a 5-year deal. Now, the Clippers, if you listen to Doc Rivers, they made it clear they wanted Chris Paul back, but I do think there was some struggle in that front office about the idea of paying a 37-year-old $40-plus million in the back end of that deal. I mean, the Rockets could conceivably, Bobby, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, they could be paying Chris Paul at 38, $40-plus million at the end of his next deal.
No, you're right. The interesting part is that he had the opportunity to make $34.6 million on a max contract. His number is 24.6, so it's a $10 million difference. You factor in that trade bonus that got added in there. And I think if you ask any person out there, if I'm going to give you a check for, 4 or 5 years, $200 million versus 1 year at 25, I think the consensus of America would say, give me the guaranteed money there. And yeah, I'm sure there's a wink, wink. I don't think there's a Joe Smith contract in the that's tucked away in the top right-hand drawer like we saw in Minnesota a long time ago and that got that organization in trouble. But yeah, an injury during a year or an ACL or Achilles, something like that, certainly presents a risk to the player. I hope he got an insurance policy with his agent. And the back end of the contract is what is always going to be the concern. Years 3, 4, 5, 37, 38, $39 million, probably 40 when we get there. And that's going to be the same thing with Kyle Lowry in Toronto. I don't think they're going to write him a blank check either. So, you get him in the still in the prime, I guess, at least for the first 2 years, and then we'll see where his body's going to be.
Paul and Harden are a top three, top four backcourt now in the NBA. But you mentioned the bench, and the next star that the Rockets are going to go out there and try to acquire, I have no doubt that phone calls are already being placed or have been placed to Indiana about a Paul George deal. I'm sure the Rockets are watching or calling about Carmelo Anthony in New York, but who do they have left to deal at this point? I mean, Trevor Ariza seems like a non-starter because of his relationship with Chris Paul and the fact they need him defensively at that position. I look down their roster, Bobby. I don't see a lot of players that I would look at as appealing assets, at least not assets that would put you in competition with Boston and LA in the Paul George sweepstakes.
No, you look at their roster and I talked to two teams and that Ryan Anderson contract.
Oh, nobody's touching that.
Teams are looking for two first. That's the going rate to take. And I like Ryan too, but I mean, that's the issue with those contracts that were signed last summer in 2016 that they're so hard to get rid of now. And now you have, Ryan Anderson 3 for 60 and is a good player, but probably not at that money. And you look at what they were able to do yesterday. They took on a bunch of non-guaranteed contracts that did not go to the Clippers, Sean Long, Ryan Kelly, Tim Quarterman. So you add that up to what you already have. If you put Ariza in there, it gets you close to where Paul George could be, but hey, you're going to have to, send out multiple, picks. And, it's interesting looking at the trade, the Rockets protected, they sent, it's a protected 1-3 for 2018 to 2023. And then it's unprotected in 2024. So basically you would have to, if you're going to move any more picks, you would have to go back and amend the protection on it and give the Clippers an unprotected pick to send out more picks because you have a 7-year rule there. So I don't know what else you have left. Is Eric Gordon appealing to teams there, but then that certainly weakens your bench.
Yeah, look, it's a bold move, but I think the bottom line for me is that as of today, and things can change, but as of today, the Rockets are the third best team in the Western Conference. I think they're still behind Golden State, and I think they're still behind San Antonio. I think chemistry takes time to figure out, and I don't see this Rockets team gelling immediately. And I think by the time they do, San Antonio, which is going to be still the Spurs next year, and they still, I think, have another trick up their sleeves this offseason with the Gasol opting out, I'd put them still firmly behind San Antonio in the West.
No, you're right, because the Rocket team right now, their margin, you know, from a roster standpoint to the bench is, you know, they cannot afford a player to get hurt, and we'll see what they'll be able to do in free agency. They have their 8-4 full mid level. They've got their biannual at 3-2. So, you know, what can you get there for, you know, maybe you can get a couple players that, you know, will come on the cheap here and be able to split it up. Who knows where they go from a trade perspective.
And I'll tell you what, too, I respect what the Clippers were able to get back in return. And I think, honestly, in some ways, Chris Paul might have saved the Clippers from themselves. I mean, the Clippers wanted Paul back. You know, Doc Rivers said this was about, or from his perspective, it was about playing with James Harden in Houston. We've all heard the rumblings about issues with Doc, issues with Blake Griffin. In the past, there have been issues with DeAndre Jordan. But Chris Paul deciding this, I don't think the Clippers were a championship team. I don't think this group was going to get past Golden State over the next 3 or 4 years. So what they would have been a 50-plus win team, if healthy, that probably would have been a second-round, maybe conference finals team. Now, it's painful, Bobby, to have to rebuild this Clippers team, but look, I think they're going to make a strong commitment to Blake Griffin at 12:01 on free agency. They still have DeAndre Jordan there. Eventually, they're going to have some cap space start to free up over the next few years. I think they're in a decent position to have sort of an expedited rebuilding process that could get them back in the mix reasonably quickly.
They're in a better position now than they were 2 days ago. And you're right. If they brought back Chris Paul and Blake, you know, basically the whole group, I don't know what would happen with Redick. You're probably a 50-win team, and you're looking at maybe a second round. And that's not good enough, not for the amount of money that you are going to pay when you look at the roster and luxury tax, because they would be a repeater tax team. And you know, when the season ended in LA, I said, you know, don't use the word blow up the team, because it's not easy to do. And I don't look at it, the Chris Paul trade as blowing up the team. It's almost like you're retooling here. And I'm a big Patrick Beverley fan. I mean, he's a pit bull. You know, so you get a starter back. Lou Williams is a sixth man. You know, Decker, you get a first round pick in 2018 for a team that had been trading out first round picks. Remember, they owe Boston a pick in 2019 that's protected, and they didn't have their first round pick this past year. So you have two first round picks in 2018. So you'll be able to, you know, replenish some of your assets. You retain your flexibility. Maybe make another deal. The Lou Williams contract is and expiring at the end of the year, and also that Jamal Crawford contract has some minimal protection in 2018. So you're able to kind of retool on the fly without, hey, if they would have let all three players go and basically clear out their bench, they would have had $37 million to fill all the holes. But now you'd be able to do it with, you know, players through a trade.
Yeah. So it's tough, and the Clippers will take a step back, no doubt. But I think it was a necessary step to at least start to move and turn the page with this team. Speaking of teams that are better off now than 2 days ago, the New York Knicks, who are much better off right now than they were 2 days ago, because Phil Jackson has been let go. We've been rough on Phil Jackson here on this podcast. I don't think any of it has been gratuitous. I think that, you know, his moves have been head-scratching. The latest, the dangling of Kristaps Porzingis before the draft was as maddening or as perplexing as any potential deal Phil Jackson has made. And, you know, James Dolan finally pulled the plug on him. And, you know, we've criticized James Dolan a lot over the last couple of years, but, you know, this was a necessary move, I think, for the franchise. I mean, Phil Jackson was not committed to this team long term, did not seem to have the requisite skills to be a general manager, certainly not the skills he had that made him a great head coach. But, you know, now that we're past the Phil Jackson era, a 3 year unimpressive era, when you look at it, Bobby, where did Phil Jackson go wrong? Where were his mistakes that caused him to be unsuccessful as a GM?
His ability to build relationships with his own players. That, I mean, I think that's a big part where he went wrong when we look at how the Carmelo Anthony relationship soured for a player that you're the one who gave him that contract. It wasn't like you got here and it was somebody else who had signed him to that long term and gave him a no trade clause and a trade kicker. And I know you lose some leverage in that, but you know that's a an albatross of a contract right now. You look at the Joakim Noah contract. I mean, there's so many different things. I mean, there were certainly some good moments with through the draft, Porzingis, Herren Gomez. But I think it comes back to how you developed relationships with your own roster. We can look at the Derrick Rose situation from last January where they failed to discipline him. I think things certainly went off the skids there. Multiple head coaches in 3 or 4 years. It's more about off the court when I think what went wrong in New York with Phil Jackson than maybe some of the on-court, decisions. I know the Noah contract's a big one, but you know, he did sign Courtney Lee. I like Courtney Lee. I think he's, serviceable too. And they were able to kind of, do some fillers around him. I guess we can pinpoint the Rose trade from last June, getting rid of, Robin Lopez at the time. I think everyone could agree would be a better player than Joakim Noah right now, mm-hmm. at that contract. So, but yeah, I mean, we can pinpoint a lot of decisions that a lot of different teams do, but it just comes back to just, I think he was just kind of out of touch with the day and age of the NBA player right now.
A couple things I want to unpack out of that. First, as a former executive, do you think it's a GM's job to deal with the media more than Phil Jackson dealt with the media?
Yes, I do. I think you've got to be transparent with the media. I don't think you need to give the media your trade secrets or your blueprint to the off season, but I think you've got to have a rapport with them because eventually you might need the media for something when there's a crisis or you got to put a fire out there, and that you need them in your corner.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you can't, and you can't, by the way, just irritate the local media, especially not New York media, by doing these national interviews without actually meeting with them. I mean, he was talking to ESPN. He was talking to CBS Sports. I mean, he was doing national stuff and not sitting down or at least having press conferences with the local media, especially. I mean, I thought the most embarrassing moment for Phil Jackson was when he sent Jeff Hornacek out to explain the Derrick Rose situation. I mean, that to me, Bobby, is a top executive's job to address what's going on with Derrick Rose, how the team's going to handle it, because ultimately it was going to be on Phil Jackson to decide what to do with Derrick Rose in that situation. He completely copped out and gave him a slap on the wrist, a financial slap on the wrist. But in that moment, he should have been front and center on that issue.
I was there. I was at that New Orleans game at the Garden when we were all, sitting in press row. We're looking at each other, figuring out where Derrick Rose is. I mean, and nobody knew where he was. And I, post game, and they basically rolled out, Jeff. And that reminded me of, and it was at the Garden too. Before that, when Okafor had the situation in Philadelphia, and they rolled out Brett Brown. I mean, I'm like, God Almighty, can these general managers step up here and take a bullet for your head coach? And it was a surreal environment that resulted in a fine. A player goes AWOL. I know there was an emergency at home, but failed to communicate with your teammates or the organization, and they basically find them a good lump sum. But, guys who make $22, $23 million, that's like toll money for them. I mean, it really is. Mm-hmm. Guys miss playing time. That's what affects them when they're either suspended or they're sitting at the end of the bench.
So Dolan now has another opportunity to hire somebody that makes sense there. And he hasn't done that in several of his chances. Hiring Isaiah Thomas with virtually no experience in that role was a mistake. Hiring Donnie Walsh was the right move, but then he, proceeded to overrule Donnie on the Melo deal and force Donnie out the back door. Glenn Grunwald, Phil Jackson. Now, we're hearing a lot about Masai Ujiri right now. And with respect to the contract, Masai just signed a long-term extension with the Raptors last year. But putting that aside for a second, if Masai Ujiri was attainable, I think he is the perfect fit for that team, Bobby, because not only is he a respected GM, a guy that's, by the way, fleeced the Knicks twice in deals with two different teams, but not only is he good at building winners, as he's done to a certain level in Denver and in Toronto, he's a personable guy. And I really think in that market, you need a guy that's transparent, that gets along with the media, that knows how to handle that type of attention. Everywhere Masai goes, people like him. He just has that magnetic personality that I think will serve him or would serve him well in a New York market. I just look at his and all the elements that he brings to the table. I just think he'd be the right guy if he was gettable for the Knicks.
And the one, he doesn't put up any bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, as nice of a person he is, I mean, he can give it right back to you. I mean, and, you know, we dealt with Masai during the Carmelo Anthony stuff back in when I was in New Jersey. There is a proven track record there, you know, especially for a person who didn't have much front office experience before he got to the Nuggets. And Denver, look what he's been able to do with that Raptor team. But I think it would have to cost New York significantly for them to allow him, yeah. You know, out of that contract, at least a first round pick there. But no, he would, and I think he can deal with James Dolan. I think David Griffin can deal with James Dolan too. I mean, I think where Griff was in Cleveland, you know, that's, you know, another situation where you're dealing with a lot of different personalities there, and that's going to be the big battle.
Yeah, he would be my number two choice on that list. I mean, and he's obviously a much more attainable guy because he's a free agent right now after leaving Cleveland. I mean, you're right. He's got the experience in pressure situations, working with big-name players, working with owners that have a history of being difficult. I just wonder if, after patting himself on the back for giving Jackson full autonomy, if Dolan's willing to do that with another GM. Because if another GM comes in there, you know, he's got to have the ability to clean house if he wants to. He's got to be able to let go of, like, the old mainstays that have been around for decades in that organization. He's got to be able to hire his own coach. I like Jeff Hornacek a lot, but if he's not David Griffin's guy, you've got to let him go. I do wonder if the next GM is going to have the same level of freedom that Phil Jackson enjoyed for a few years.
I would hope so. I would hope James Dolan has learned through basically what he's been able to do has not worked. I hope the one thing I hope doesn't happen is that, you know, James Dolan figures, hey, I gave a guy, you know, 3 years or 4 years the keys to the car here, and he basically came back and it was all broken up, and that now I've got to kind of manage. Maybe I need to manage people better, which would be the worst thing, for the New York. But I, you know, if it's Masai or even Griff, I would not take that job if it wasn't. I wouldn't go there just to be the GM. I would want to be the president, to be in control. Of course, you know, you would have to go through James Dolan from a decision making, but I would want full autonomy.
What I would do too, if I'm the Knicks and we're just a day away from free agency, I would do nothing. Like, until you have a full time top executive in place, I would do nothing. I certainly wouldn't hand out a contract longer than 1 year. I mean, if Derrick Rose wants to come back on a one-year deal, fine. You want to bring him back, give it to him. But you can't give these guys long-term contracts if these are not going to be the guys that are ultimately making the decisions and shaping the future of this team. You've got to keep it all on short-term deals and keep your mistakes to a minimum. And really, there's more internal things that need to be repaired. I mean, you got to figure out what to do with Carmelo right now. Do you repair that relationship, or do you continue to try to find a trade partner? They made it pretty clear they're not going to buy Carmelo Anthony out, not unless he gives them a massive discount on what he was supposed to be making. You've got to repair the Porzingis deal. I mean, if I'm the Knicks, the guys I know are going to be around, namely Jeff Hornacek and maybe a couple others, I would fly them to Latvia. I would sit down with Porzingis and say, look, Phil's gone. We're going to try to turn the page here. We want you around. You're our franchise player. Try to rebuild that. To me, there's so much more internal things, Bobby, that the Knicks could fix without going out and handing out another bad contract that might haunt them down the line.
They'll have, if you take the Rose cap hold off, they'll have about $15 million. And what I would do is basically split that up and get a point guard and get a shooting guard and sign them to 1 year deals. Get a mentor for your rookie point guard. You need another wing behind Courtney Lee. Your 3 4s and 5 are pretty much set there. So yeah, no, I would not go out and sign a guy to a $52 million, 4 years, $52 million contract at Jeff Teague or Drew Holiday. I think that's a little bit too low for both players. And then it goes back to Porzingis. I'm still amazed that there's been no face to face meeting there, and that nobody from that organization has flown out there to meet them with him. Maybe that changes now with Phil gone.
Yeah. Well, I think the last part of Phil's legacy with New York is going to be what happens with Neal Aquina, because he drafted Neal Aquina. That was his decision. I assume part of it was because he believes Neal Aquina is a better fit in the triangle than somebody else that might have been available. But the Mavericks grabbed Dennis Smith at the pick right afterwards. And I think if Dennis Smith turns out to be a better player, that could be another, you know, haunting of the Knicks and of the Phil Jackson era there. So
well, and that would be on James Dolan then.
Yeah.
That would be on him, because you let a guy go into the draft last Thursday. When were you thinking of letting him go? Was it over this past weekend? Was it earlier in this week? And if you thought about it before the draft, then why didn't you pull the plug then? So that would be on James Dolan if what you picked at number eight, you know, doesn't turn out to be that point guard of your future, and Dennis Smith turns out to be the next, you know, John Wall. Mm. I mean, that's on the owner right there.
Yeah. And Dennis Smith, I think, has more natural talent than Neal Aquina, but he's got some, you know, he sort of plateaued last year towards the end of the season at NC State, had his own issues there. And Neal Aquina is still a good player. I mean, it's not like he was brought in just for the triangle. He's already, I think, an NBA defensive player right away, but that they're going to be tied together. No question about that for the foreseeable future. All right, let's talk about what's going to happen just after midnight on Friday when NBA free agency officially opens. The big name that is going to be in the contention is going to be Gordon Hayward. And Hayward has already lined up what he's going to do in the interview process. The Salt Lake Tribune had this first, where they have Miami meeting with Gordon Hayward on Saturday. I believe it's the Jazz on Sunday. And then the Celtics, they'll get the last meeting. So those three, in some order, over the first few days of free agency, it's going to be Miami, Utah, and Boston. Now, let me ask this first, Bobby, as somebody that's done this before. Does the order matter?
It matters for me. I like to go last. I do. I think what your lasting impression has on a player plays a big role here. But every team's going to make their own pitch, and it's funny, it's the day and age of, we did it in New Jersey, and it totally backfires on you, where you're like, you go out there and you're kind of pitching everything else but the basketball product. You have, you know, iPad presentations, the marketing, a new arena, all those things, and, you know, players care about it, probably secondary, but all three of these teams that they're going to meet with, it's all about basketball. I mean, Pat Riley in Miami, Andy Ellsberg, they're the masters of the presentation. I mean, they'll be able to sell him on the culture of the Heat organization. You look at Boston, you know, they've already got a, you know, what they did last year. You could probably use that as a carryover when you went through Durant, you know, Horford, players like that. And then you've got Utah, who's got that comfort level there. And we're able to probably meet with him before you know, free agency took place, because he was still a player on the roster if they wanted to. So I do believe it matters as far as a lasting impression. I think there's certainly a great relationship with the Jazz based on him being there 7 or 8 years. And I mean, but there's also a relation. Every team has something to sell. I mean, I think Miami has it, where you look at their track record, championships, player development, how they can get better. No, you know, of course, no state taxes there. I mean, that probably plays into it. You know, Boston, you know, where they were in an Eastern Conference Finals, probably don't have to really gut it. And then, of course, Utah. The interesting part with him, though, Chris, is how long of a contract will he sign?
Yeah.
You know, will it be 3 years? Will it be 4 or 5? You know, 3 years takes him to, you know, who he would be a free agent and have, you know, 10 plus years of service when his free agency is up. But I would have a hard time that a team would be willing to commit, you know, $35, $36 million when he's a free agent. I mean, that's still a big number. So I think, you know, him meeting with the Jazz last, the length of the contract, those are probably the two things to focus on.
Yeah. And look, you've done this before. You brought up what a team can be saying while the guy's still under contract. You had Deron Williams when Deron was still under contract before he signed his big deal with the Nets. I mean, how much communication did you have with Deron Williams during that time? And how much do you think the Jazz are probably having with Gordon Hayward at this point?
Well, it's funny. We Billy and ownership met with Deron on the 1st of July, and we did not get a commitment from him. I think he met with the Mavericks that day also. And I remember in my office at the practice facility, I had a window office, and I could see when the players came in and out of the facility in their cars. And for like 4 days, like, Deron Williams would come to the facility and work out without, you know, we didn't know if he was going to sign or not. it was like the most surreal thing. I'm like, is this guy going to commit? You know, like when's the day here? And yeah, I mean, you can have, I think to have the player on your roster, you can in-house recruit him for a year. I think that's the advantage that, you know, Utah had. I mean, they've had him for multiple years here versus maybe some of these other teams that they're going into the meeting for the first time.
Yeah. I wonder, and look, Gordon Hayward strikes me, and he strikes a lot of people I talk to around the league, as someone that's going to have a really tough time with this decision. I mean, practically, Boston makes the most sense. He goes to Boston, he signs that four-year deal with a third-year opt-out or something along those lines. He can play in the Eastern Conference. He can play for a team that doesn't need him to be the alpha, doesn't need him to be the guy that carries the load as he has offensively at times in Utah. And he'd be away from Golden State, which after getting broomed by them in the conference playoffs just a few months ago, that has to still resonate somewhat in his mind. But leaving Utah and walking away, I just get the sense that a guy like Gordon Hayward, that's going to resonate a little bit more with than others. I don't think this is a... You know, he meets with all three teams and he makes a decision that night. I think this might drag out a couple of extra days because of who Gordon Hayward is.
No, you're right. And there's always a few players that kind of, you know, puts free agency kind of in a stalemate here. And he'll be one of them. Blake Griffin will probably be another player that, you know, we'll talk about. Probably the same teams he'll meet with, I believe, you know, Miami and Boston also. What happens with Paul Millsap in Atlanta? Those are some of your moving parts where, you know, if it's a team that has cap space, you can sign them outright. And then if you get if Hayward got a commitment, if he gave a commitment to Boston, then, you know, they'd have to, you know, get some salary, salary off maybe a Terry Rozier contract and renounce some players here. So, but yeah, there's a lot of things in play. And then that affects, you know, players who are, you know, 10 to 20 ranked in free agency, the Holidays, the Teagues, the Rose, we haven't even talked about the Golden State guys. So, but those guys will control free agency, at least for the first couple days here.
You know, the other thing we don't know exactly what conversations, if any, that have happened between Gordon Hayward and Paul George. We've seen Woj had the report about how Boston was trying to coordinate this and make it so that they can sign Gordon Hayward and trade for Paul George. They clearly have the assets to do that. And, you know, you can always, as we saw with Houston, you could always make the finances work through some way or another. But, you know, I would imagine, these guys have been all-stars together. You know, these guys are elite players. I would imagine they could find each other's phone numbers and have some kind of conversation about this, about how they'd play together, about how it would work, if they both want it. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, Bobby, if this gets done, that we hear about some kind of dialogue. I mean, we just heard about Harden and Chris Paul. We have come off the Super Friends era, as it was in Miami, about, you know, what's happened in Cleveland with LeBron and Kevin Love talking and that re-signing happening. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if this turned out to be a conversation with these two guys that got a deal done.
I shouldn't. I mean, if I'm Gordon Hayward, I would, you know, certainly, or if I'm Paul George, you know, there should be a line of communication here, because it's been well reported. Woj reported this week that, you know, maybe these two players, you know, team up. Now, who's going to play the two? Who's going to play three? I mean, how, you know, from a lineup standpoint.
Do you think that Hayward can play the two?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on how teams line up. I mean, if teams roll out two point guards, I think he'll have his hands full there. Mm. You know, can you go? I mean, what's Paul George's reluctance to play the four? I mean, you know, we saw it in.
He was reluctant in Indiana. Yeah, he didn't want any part of that.
And then we remember Al Horford's reluctant to play the five.
Yeah.
So there's like.
He'll tell you, not a five.
Yeah. I mean, he probably wished that Gordon Hayward was a true two and that, you know, with Paul George at the three there. But yeah, no, they've got the. They can sign Hayward outright, and then they've got the assets to make a deal. I mean, it's going to cost you probably Crowder and Avery Bradley and you know, probably a pick or two here to do so. And then what's the Paul George commitment? You know, long term. That's the other thing. As far as, are you willing to take on a one year rental? And you know, Bradley would have been a free agent next year in 2018. You would have to give up an asset there. So a lot of moving parts with the Celtics.
Yeah. My initial thought when the George Hayward stuff was floated was that they are kind of redundant. They both are small forwards, And I don't know if Hayward wants to play the two. We know Paul George doesn't want to play the four. I guess you can make anything work with talented guys, but that four position, I don't think you're going to have a lot of success convincing Paul George to be a full-time four, especially when he's got a smaller five playing alongside him in Al Horford. I mean, you'd be an unbelievably dynamic offensive team, and you'd lock down the perimeter. But against that handful of bigger teams, including Cleveland, by the way, which would still be able to roll out right now, Tristan Thompson and Kevin Love, you'd be significantly handicapped playing those two guys at front court positions.
No, and then what happens when if he goes through a year, if he's playing the majority of his playing minutes at the four, I mean, you get to free agency and be like, whoa, this is not for me. I want to go to L.A. and play to three, and I don't know if I want to commit there long term. So it sounds good, it looks good, but when you put it all together on the court, it's like you have to make the pieces fit here.
You know, all the talk about Paul George, it has to scare the Lakers a little bit, right? I mean, if I'm Magic Johnson and Rob Pelinka, and I hear about what Boston's trying to do, and I know what Houston's trying to do, doesn't this sort of push you to be more proactive in making a deal? Now, they've already given up one asset to get Mozgov off the books and D'Angelo Russell. We've read and heard that Brandon Ingram might be untouchable out there. I don't know that should be the case, if it is. But don't you think that the Lakers right now have to be more proactive about making a deal and not crossing their fingers and hoping that Paul George hates Boston or hates Houston or hates wherever he winds up playing and still wants to walk away at the end of 2018?
Well, they should be concerned because it goes back to how, Kevin Pritchard, the GM in Indiana, can kind of create leverage between multiple teams here. I didn't think Kevin had much leverage there, basically on a player who, had already publicly said that he wasn't going to resign there on a one-year deal. So, but if I'm Los Angeles, I'm still not taking that, ultimate aggressive approach where I'm going to give up an Ingram or, a future pick here, Clarkson, Randall. Yeah, I mean, that's fine. But I think Ingram is tough to move because now it goes back to, a conversation for Magic Johnson or Rob Pelinka to have with Aaron Mintz. Hey, is your guy coming or not? Or should we be concerned? Because if he's coming and we have your word, then we're not going to risk, assets, future picks to do so. We'll just sign him with room.
Yeah. You think Ingram should be untouchable?
I do. I just look at the Laker team in general, and I don't see them as a playoff team with Paul George on it. If they added him in a trade, I don't see them a playoff team right now. I think it's got to be a slow build there. I really do. I think if you can add George in the offseason, figure out what you can do with the rest of the roster to create maybe some more room to add another max-type player. I don't think you have to, there'll be other really good players next summer. Maybe Russell Westbrook would be available. We haven't really talked about him. We don't know what about his future in Oklahoma City. LeBron, we can talk about. So I would not risk a lot just to get him, under my roof.
I think Westbrook signs at 12:01.
I do. He might shock us all. 5 years, $200 million off the bat.
I mean, first of all, he likes playing out there. And he likes money. So, and he knows what the score is. Like, if he turns it down, I mean, his world gets turned upside down. All of a sudden, some other things come into play, trades and whatnot. I don't know. I don't have any sort of inside information there, and I don't think Oklahoma City is at all confident that that's going to happen necessarily at 12:01, but that wouldn't surprise me if the Thunder make a presentation and he signs that extension right away. Because they've got to be talking to him about this. I mean, knowing Oklahoma City, and you know them as well as I do, they've been discussing all these things with Thad Fouché, who's Russell's agent, and with Russell, I'm sure, himself. I mean, plus, I've always been told by people in Oklahoma City that, and this goes back about a year plus, that their general feeling was that re-signing Kevin Durant was going to prove to be more difficult than re-signing Russell Westbrook. And they just believe, and they have believed, that Russell likes being there, that the fashion world that he's into is great in the off-season, but not something he really chooses to dive deep into during the season. He just likes basketball during the season. And if that's the case, not many better place to just focus on basketball than Oklahoma City.
I'm sure there was a conversation in late December when we reported that Westbrook and Harden were grandfathered in with the designated player veteran extension that they would be eligible for, 5 years. At the time, I think it was 205. I think it's now going to be around, right around that number too. And it goes back to when we were talking about Chris Paul. It's hard to turn down a blank check. And they hand it to you and you've got guaranteed financial security for the next 5 years, no matter what happens on the court. And I think what you'll see is I think Oklahoma City will be aggressive in free agency. I think I'm just looking at Woj right now. He tweeted that Oklahoma City could be a possible fit if they can make it work there. Cap wise, it doesn't because where they are financially, but they've got such a young roster. So he knows what's there already. So, if he doesn't turn it down, then we go through a season of a player on the last year of his contract. It's interesting with that designated player veteran extension, which is, the goal is to reward a player for, to bump you up into a different salary criteria. Is that the same amount of money that he could sign for an extension would be the same amount of money that he would get in 2018, no matter what happens. But it's more about, getting that security right now.
If you're, just to pivot it back to Hayward for a second, and also another free agent in George Hill, if you're Gordon Hayward, and you say to Utah, you can get me back, but you have to pay George Hill. You have to get him back into the fold first. And we know that George Hill is going to want a big contract. We also know he's been injury prone at 31 years old. Those things do not tend to line up with executives that want to hand out those types of contracts. But if you're Gordon Hayward, you say that. Do the Jazz have to do it? They just drafted a potential point guard replacement last week. But do you still have to do kind of Gordon Hayward's bidding if that's what he says will get it done?
Not necessarily. I think what the conversation should be with Hayward, and I say this with really any free agent, the marquee free agents when they go on their meetings, is basically show me what the roster is going to look like. If I commit to you, show me what it's going to, where are your conversations with other players? If it's, if it's Hayward going to Boston, who is not going to be here? Players are smart these days. They know the salary cap. They know what rosters look like. So if I'm sitting down with, Dennis Lindsay, the Jazz general manager, and I'm Gordon Hayward, I want to know, all right, where are we with free agency? Show me, what pieces can we bring back? Can we bring back Joe Ingles? If I'm coming in at 29.7, what money do we have slotted for, for George Hill? And if not, what's the replay? What's options B, C, and D? Can we go out and get another point guard? That cap wise, it's going to be going to be tricky there, based on that, because they'll still be over with his cap hold. So I think that's more of a conversation than saying, hey, I'm not coming back unless we pay George Hill, for $80 million. I think you can go about it in a certain way, in a respectful way, and really get your point across.
All right, let's talk about a couple of risky free agents out there. And the first one's Paul Millsap, who is a very good player. And if he was on a short-term deal, you'd love him. But he's 32 years old, going to be looking for big money in what's probably going to be his last big contract. He has had diminishing returns from the three-point line. The age, obviously, is a big factor. I don't think Atlanta makes him a substantive offer. Travis Schlenk told me recently that he's not inclined to hand out long-term contracts. He thinks that's, at this stage of this team, that's what gets you in a lot of trouble. They just moved off Dwight Howard. I just can't see them, Bobby, offering a five-year type of deal to Paul Millsap. I just don't see it.
No, I don't either. I mean, he opted out of, I think, 21-3.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe call me crazy, but I don't see him making maybe a little bit more than that number, 24. I would be stunned, Chris. And hey, maybe there's a team out there, there's always one, that gives him a max contract starting at $34.6 million. I look at the landscape of the league, and it goes back to some of those point guards also, is that, well, who's the team? And who's, what team does Paul Millsap want to commit to? And there's not many that have room that are playoff, caliber team. Of course, teams can create the cap space, but and it all goes back to, Chris Paul. I mean, you're going to be paying Millsap, 37, 38 towards the million towards the back end of that contract. So while I agree that he should have opted out to kind of, look at your options there, I just have a hard time him making more than, you know, $24, $25 million.
All right, the other guy is another another point guard that in this massive crop of quality point guard seems to be out there right now. Jrue Holiday with New Orleans, 27 years old. On paper, a very good player, but he's dealt with injuries over the course of his career. What kind of offer do you think Holiday's going to make out there? We've heard Dallas is interested on some level, and obviously New Orleans, I think, would want to have him back if the price is right.
I'm going to throw something crazy at you here. I'm going to say that when the dust settles outside of Steph Curry and probably Kyle Lowry, that Jrue Holiday would be the top point guard paid in this crop of free agents.
Really?
I think he's going to get – I think New Orleans is so backed into a corner right now and have no leverage at all based on where their roster is, with DeMarcus Cousins entering the final year of his contract and Anthony Davis in the prime of his career, that they're going to offer him like a contract of like $25 million plus. Because if you let him go, it's almost like Mike Conley in Memphis. I mean, well, who else is out there? Mm-hmm. I mean, you got $13 million in cap space. So is that good enough? And you don't have a backup. I mean, you traded Tim Frazier a week ago. So there's really nobody out there unless they just patch a, you know, then maybe they go out and get, you know, Patty Mills. I mean, possibly. But I think Holiday is an overpay in New Orleans. And I think it's based on, lack of leverage there. Dallas, on the other hand, I don't see them just based on, you know, that Dennis Smith draft to go out and, you know, pay a top-notch point guard $17, $18 million.
Yeah. All right, so look, you've done the free agent list, and if you want to look at Bobby's free agent list, it's up on thevertical.com. The Vertical's top 20 free agents is up there. When you look at the rest of the list, Bobby, who's the most intriguing free agent out of the rest of the guys that we haven't talked about?
Well, I think it's the restricted guys. I think the restricted free agents, you know, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, Otto Porter, Andre Roberson, Bojan Bogdanovic, players like that. Restricted free agency is a tricky proposition. This year, the rules change a little bit that you can sign an offer sheet on the 1st of July, but the clock doesn't start until the moratorium is lifted on July 6th at noon. So, you know, what team comes in and slaps down a big offer sheet? Brooklyn on Pope or Porter, possibly. It's going to cost them probably the max. So are they willing to do that? And what does Detroit do? I know they're hesitant to pay him that the top dollar. I think Washington doesn't have much of a choice. But I like watching it's like a cat and mouse race with restricted free agents, as far as the team always has leverage until you get that offer sheet. So I think those are some of the four or five guys that, you know, we should probably pay attention to.
I'm looking at Zach Randolph and what he does, because Zach Randolph is still a productive off the bench player, even at 35 years old. And it does seem like, based on what we saw from the David Fizdale year, that they're moving away from that brand of basketball. They'd like to play a more versatile guy, Jamichael Green, at the power forward position alongside Marc Gasol. So I don't think they're going to break the bank to bring Randolph back. Not that I think that other teams will as well. I'm curious with Randolph, if he tries to find a contender, if he says, I've made a whole bunch of money in my career, I don't have a championship ring, I don't have a lot of playoff success outside of that one conference finals run with Memphis, maybe I'll latch on with a team like a Cleveland or a Golden State or a Boston or somebody else that could use me in a sixth man role. Because I think in that capacity, as a seventh or eighth man, Zach Randolph can still be incredibly valuable to a team.
No, he's made $176 million and he's going to be 36 in July. So what do you have left in the tank there? And I think he could still produce at a pretty good clip. So if you signed him on a 2-year contract, would he go somewhere for the tax mid level or part of the full mid level, which would be a little bit north of $5 million? He has certainly adjusted to whatever role you give him. He's proven that he can start. He's done that for the long haul in Memphis, and then last year you saw him come off the bench when, you know, Jamichael Green was inserted into the starting lineup. So from a role standpoint, you know already that he can do both. So, but that is an interesting name, because they're another team that, you know, they spent a lot of money last summer on, you know, Chandler Parsons. We talked about Conley Jr. Jamichael Green's a restricted free agent with bird rights. Tony Allen, not going to be able to, certainly not going to be able to afford all three players. And you've already got, $93 million plus in guaranteed contracts. So, he could be, the short, end of the stick based on what happens with Green.
Should be fun. Friday night, 12:01, free agency starts. Could be a wild weekend. And even after that, into the 4th of July, as it often is in the NBA. Bobby, these podcasts have been fun, man. Hope we get to do it again sometime soon.
Chris, it's been my pleasure, my friend. It's been a great ride here.
You want a Boston Nets joke to go?
Might as well, right?
put on the spot. I mean, the lights are in my eyes. I don't even know. I usually get teed up. Somebody usually says something like, Boston has a well of assets, and the mind goes to Bobby.
Here you go. I got one for you. Okay. Bobby, why didn't you put any protection on those picks?
That's too nerdy. That's way too nerdy. All right, Bobby, we'll catch up down the road.
All right, man. Talk to you.
That's it for this week's bonus episode. My thanks to Bobby Marks for joining the show. As always, check out archived episodes on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, leave us a rating, post a comment. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.